Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You're listening to the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, episode 34. Casey Anderson is an Emmy-nominated filmmaker, an adventurer, explorer, and TV host. He has spent the last three decades traveling the world, capturing nature and wildlife through the camera lens. Born and raised in Montana, Anderson spent his childhood exploring the vast wilderness that was his backyard. And by the age of 18, Casey was guiding wildlife filmmakers into remote locations to track and film the most elusive wild animals. At 26, he adopted an orphaned grizzly bear, which led him to co-found the Montana Grizzly Encounter, a sanctuary for grizzly bears saved from inhumane situations. As a television personality, Casey has been on the Nat Geo Wild Channel, BBC, PBS, Travel Channel, Discovery Channel, and has been a regular contributor to Conan and Oprah. He has made it his mission to bring his love for the wild into the hearts of the world, instilling a drive to conserve untamed and untouched wild places. Casey's films include Monster Encounters, America the Wild, The Mountain Lion and Me, Finding Beasts, Casey's Wild Backyard, Bear With Me, Man vs. Bear, and Expedition Wild. Good morning, Casey. Thank you so much for taking the time out to be on the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast. How's it going for you this morning?
It's going well, man. Thanks for having me on here.
Awesome. It's a pleasure. It's an absolute pleasure. I think our listeners are going to get a lot out of this because you are a man of many, many talents. I want to start really, like I do with all of these, of just getting into the nitty gritty of how you got into the wildlife filmmaking industry. You know, going back as far as you want. You know, what was it that spurred your career and got you into this industry?
Well, you know, being born and raised in Montana was really the start of it. You know, having the wild right out the back door. I was that kid that was just always running around out in the woods, fell in love with the woods, fell in love with animals, had parents that recognized that passion and didn't tell me not to do it. You know, so I knew I was always going to do something with animals. I had, you know, volunteering, wildlife rehab centers, things like that. But then I went to college to study wildlife biology. And in the summer months for jobs, I started just going down into Yellowstone and meeting people and, you know, helping people do things that down there with wildlife. But one thing that came to me was, you know, these guys from Los Angeles or New York would show up in Yellowstone. They had to make a wildlife documentary and they didn't know where to find a grizzly bear or a pack of wolves or whatever. So they would hire this 18-year-old kid to find him for it and carry all their heavy gear to the wherever the bears were. And that's how I started off. I mean, I was doing that a lot in college and started making a bit of a reputation because I was finding some of the critters for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know how it is when you start doing things like that, then it turns into, hey, I've got this other camera. Maybe you should hit record on it. Or, you know, you just start getting involved more in the process. And yeah, that's how it started. And then it just snowballed and snowballed from there. And I've done a little bit of everything since then.
That's fantastic. So you literally were just, you were there while they were recording, you got involved a bit. What was the first kind of key moment that got you either in front of a camera or behind the camera? What was the first thing that actually was the first career move in terms of actually doing something with a program, a wildlife program?
One that sticks out in my mind was, it was the year that they introduced the wolves to Yellowstone. It was a man from LA who was doing this series called Safari, played like on Outdoor Network or something, but he had to do like 30 half hour episodes. So he was just doing a bunch of things. And I had been paying attention. I knew where some of these secret holding pens were.
Right.
And I met this guy and he was just asking about the wolf thing. And he was trying to, you know, cover this new thing that was happening and whatever. And I said, hey, I know how we can climb up this ridge and come down the back and get a little sneak peek down into the holding pens. And he's like, really? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, it's not illegal. You know, it's like, I just know the way and I know where these are. So he was pretty interested and I snuck him in there. We filmed some of the wolves who were running around in there, pacing around, waiting to be released, which is cool. Now that in retrospect, you know,
yeah,
that was a budding thing and to happen. And then that whole thing with wolves have happened. And I've revisited the ancestors of those first wolves many times since then. But yeah, that was it. That was like, I've made a relationship with that guy and continued up working with him and did several things, took me to Africa and India and everything after that. So that was really the key move was that one.
Fantastic. And now, of course, your credits are you're a TV host, you're a producer, you're a camera person, you're an executive producer. Just what would you say is the main one of those titles that is the biggest percentage of what you do?
It's changing. It's ever evolving. I mean, I started my own production company, Vision Hawk Films. So I never thought I was going to do that. So now, I mean, I'm kind of doing a bit of being, getting gray in my beard and I'm being more of a boss, I guess, you know,
right.
overseeing productions. But at the same time, I'm still hosting and I run cameras constantly. I mean, part of that, we do a lot of stuff within my production company that is either me hosting or I'm being a cinematographer. So I guess what's changed, I have to worry about other people, you know, in the past, it was just worrying about me, which is, you know, navigating that. I don't know. I mean, I think the older you get, and the more you learn, I mean, now it's been, we'll be pushing 30 years here, 25 years been doing this. And I, you know, now I've got kids that were that kid that I was when I was, 18 in Yellowstone that work for me. And, it's fun because it's, you learn a lot in 25 years and you've got a lot to learn yet too, but you have a lot you can pass on to people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I find in this industry, and I think everybody can say this, is that when you look back on it, it's who you know and how hard you work for those people that you know and that reputation you make and being a good person. And that counts a lot in this industry.
Yeah, we hear that a lot. An absolute lot. Yeah. I mean, in terms of from my, traveling the world with a small crew, understanding that it's about what those people are like that you're with, not necessarily their skill set. You know, the skill set can be learned as you go along to some degree. But if you don't get along with someone and you're spending months in the field, that's a whole different, a whole different thing. So personality comes into this a huge amount. So if you had to pick one of those jobs that you do, one of the roles, what would you say is your favorite? Do you have something that you would much prefer to do getting up every morning? You know, would it be heading out to be a host or heading out with a camera on your shoulder?
Yeah, good question. You know, the thing that really keeps me excited is, I mean, it's a little bit of everything in those, but it's more of the subject matter. I think it's like, if someone comes to me I'll just give an example and I can't give you too many details yet, but someone comes to me and says, hey, do you think you could film this animal that's never been filmed before in this location? Right.
Yep.
And in this case, it was mountain lion, something I know quite a bit about. I'm like, yeah, I think I can. I mean, I want to try, nothing's impossible. If this animal walks and lives, it leaves tracks. I can follow the tracks. I can get a pattern down. If I get a pattern down, I can start making some predictable moves. I can make some predictable moves and get something on camera. And if I get something on camera, maybe I can start telling a story and now we can start doing something here. Right.
Yeah.
So I love those challenges. Now, whether it's, at some level, it almost comes back to me as a kid, that those things that excite me. It's the naturalist aspect of this whole thing. It's the tracking. It's the understanding behavior, trying to tell these stories that people can't tell very easily. You know, I love when someone comes to me and says it's impossible. Yeah. Those are the things that make me excited. So those are, that's, you know, and sometimes that's running the camera. Sometimes that's being a host and talking about the situation. And sometimes it's all of them, you know. I'm going to be going to Kodiak here with a team of two young kids and me. And, you know, I'm going to be running camera. I'm going to be being the executive producer, director. I'm going to be hosting the little shows that we're going to be doing. And I'm going to be hoping these kids are, like I said, easy to get along with in a tent for a month. We'll find out.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a great answer because, you know, I think what is so important is animal behavior in this industry. I mean, like you said, when you started out, that people coming to you, you know, how do we find these animals? Where are they? How do you track them? You know, we want to film them. You have that experience. And actually, we're quite similar. I grew up running a wildlife park in the UK, an animal sanctuary for 15 years or so, you know, once I was an adult. But I was there from like 10 years old. And it was that understanding of animals, animal behavior, that for me led into this career. And helps me, you know, learning a camera, you can do in a few weeks, a few months. It's just another skill set you add and you just practice, and you get it. But learning animal behavior is nowhere near that simple. I mean, you might be able to go out and spend a few weeks with a species and start to see and understand what's going on. But to have a good understanding of lots of different species, mammals, you know, birds, insects, whatever it might be, is a whole different thing. And I think it's something that's so overlooked. I get so many questions from people, aspiring filmmakers, wanting to get into the industry. And they're like, what camera should I get? What should I do? And I say, well, hang on, what have you done? You know, this, that, and the other. And so much of the time they've done nothing. They've not put any time into the wildlife side of things and understanding any kind of behavior, whether it's of their own cat in their house and looking at how it, you know, gets ready to pounce when it's playing. It's those kind of things. So it's really good to hear you say that because I think that's what drives me as well. I mean, I love being out there. If I'm filming, so, you know, if I'm being paid to film, then that's the best it can be. But if I'm out there seeing animals in their natural habitat, doing what they do, I'm a happy person. That keeps me going. So
I think,
go ahead.
What you're saying, I mean, you know, it's interesting that, you know, the idea that, you know, you grew up in the rehab center, you got to watch animals, and it is a secret weapon, man, because as soon as you can start to anticipate behavior, you know when they pick their head up, that means they might walk.
That's right.
And now you can let that pan a little bit sooner or whatever. And I think a lot of times when you see people, especially working a camera, that are really good, is they have that anticipation of behavior.
Yeah.
And then they can really start to, you know, technically they can do it all, but there's now the artistic side can come in because they're not just playing catch up all the time. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. You're filming sequences at that point, which is what it's all about, right? It's telling a story with images. And I think, you know, that's the most valid part of being a camera person that I, when people come to me and ask, it's always about image sequences. Anyone can pick up a camera. And the thing about today is that anyone can pick up a good camera. It, you know, used to be you'd spend $100,000 for a broadcast camera. Now, gosh, $2,500 you can get a camera that films some incredible images. And so that's not the thing that stops us from doing it. It's now understanding that a good image sequence is what people want to see, a good story. I say this time and time again, we can watch shows with incredible imagery. If it's a terrible story, no one stays to watch it. You know, whereas the other way around, if it's mediocre camera work, but it's a great story, you'll stay and watch it. So now you bring those two great stories and great image sequences together and you've got a pure winner. And so it's so important. So going back to the roles, you know, a lot of the people listening and watching are aspiring filmmakers. They get very confused about the terminology of all of these roles. I think, you know, camera person, host is pretty obvious. But when we start talking about producing, directing, executive producers, people get confused as to what we're talking about. Directing, again, I think is fairly obvious. But just explain a little bit about your roles in terms of executive producing, and, you know, anything else that you take on like that.
Yeah, a lot. Be honest. Sometimes I don't know if there is a real definition to those.
Right.
The word producer, man, it can be. I always say producers have the hardest job, and it's also often the most thankless job. Everything that needs to be worked out from logistics to whatever, just figuring out the plan. That's hard. And it's so essential. And there are people that it can you can be very good at it, or you can be really terrible at it. We've all worked for each, right?
Yes, for sure.
But a good producer who can put together a good plan so everybody else can do their job well and not worry about, if they're going to eat the next day. That's good. That's a good thing. I think on the executive producer side, I think, in my role with that is it's semi-specific. Being a wildlife host, being in an industry a long time, as you know, it's a small world. Everybody knows everybody. And it's funny. It's you go to one of these Jackson Hole Wildlife Film Festival, for example. You go there and it's always the same thing. It's like, you walk in there and there's all these familiar faces that just grew 2 years older, right? And they're all your buddies, and you say hi, and it's like you've worked with them or you wish you could work with them, but you know everybody there. And then there's like kind of the young class, right? That always shows up to those things. And the next 2 years later, half of that young class, if not more, they've gone extinct. But some stick around, right? Some stick around. And next year, half of those are gone, but some stick around. And then they end up being your buddies, and they end up being people that you know well, and they're people that you're going to be doing business with. So in the executive business producer side, I think that that's a big key thing is nurturing and utilizing those relationships to build programs. I have made some wonderful friends and through the years, and a lot of it comes from actually access and being a host. When you're a host, you have open doors to networks. It's for some reason, right? And and not very many production companies that are just starting out can pick up the phone and call Netflix and say, "I got to pitch something," and they're like, "Hey, pitch it to me now." So I think from the executive producer side, it's that's what I'm doing a lot of the time in that role, is just kind of taking in, ideas and kind of sifting through them and seeing if they're good, and then trying to marry them to, try to make stories and then see where the stories are gonna, who's looking for what kind of stories out there in the network world, and then taking some of those other relationships that I've met along the way, like this good director, this good producer, this good camera guy. Putting them together because they're going to be really good at shooting moose or whatever, and then pitching it to this guy. And it's yeah, that's where that executive producer role comes from on my end. And and that's kind of why I started my production company, is because having all those relationships and putting that all together, it seemed like it would be a shame not to utilize all those awesome relationships that I've made over the years and try to tell some awesome stories. So that's the definition of that role in my mind.
No, I think, as you say, there's kind of a mix between them, but I very much see that as the roles as well. Producers being more very much project specific and working on, working out the details of each project, logistics and what have you, and so forth. I would love to get on to, well, first of all, before we move on to, we'll talk about Puma's Legends of the Ice Mountain, because that's something close to my heart. I don't know whether my wife is a mountain lion biologist. We spent years in the field, capturing, collaring 70 odd mountain lions in the Reno, Sierra Nevada mountain ranges. So we'll get on to that because I've got some great questions to ask you. But what I'd love to do is first go back a little bit and ask you about Brutus. How's Brutus doing?
Well, that's a sad question. Actually, Bruce
Oh.
died in
Oh.
February.
I didn't know. I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. No, it's the elephant in the room otherwise. I know he was having some mobility issues, and we took him into this University of Washington, or Washington State University, just to do some MRIs and see what was going on. And then you got anesthetize a bear, and sometimes things just don't. He didn't come out of it. And
Oh, man.
and that happened in February. And it's been a bummer because that bear definitely defined a lot of who I am. There's no doubt about that. You know, and it's interesting, you know, learning a little bit about your background. Now, you know, that bear, you know, simultaneously with all this filmmaking stuff, I was consulting at wildlife parks, working with a lot of different wildlife parks. Cause I had that skill set too, especially in my younger years. And, you know, I gained a lot of that same knowledge that you did in talking about that.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Even if it comes down to just, you know, you walk in and you're like, you've been cleaning fox crap for 2 weeks, and then you walk out in the wild, and as soon as you smell a fox, you know no doubt what it is because you've had that catalog in your head, right?
Yeah.
But what the cool thing with Brutus is, you know, rescuing him when he, you know, 20 years ago, deciding to start a sanctuary to rescue grizzly bears. I mean, and I was 25 years old, and crazy to think about.
Yeah.
And then forming that relationship with him specifically. And learning the intricacies of a grizzly bear and just this, you know, the thing, an animal that I was watching and filming and studying out in the wild constantly, and how much he taught me about grizzly bears, was amazing. But then, you know, even beyond that, and it has really become my mantra at this point, is that got me that these individual beings out there have their own personalities. They're all a product of their own life and experiences.
Yeah.
And, you know, to think, okay, if Brutus could feel and be this way, why not that bear over there? Why not that bear? So you start looking at the wild world instead of, you know, just grizzly bears or just mountain lions. You see them as a group of individuals that are making their own choices and doing things individually. And it just, then if you look at it that way, it, you just think of all the stories that can be told out there.
Yeah.
And they're sure. relatable to people. So, you know, he changed my life. He really did. And, you know, there's still other bears at the sanctuary. You know, and, it still could, but I'll never have a relationship like I did with him, but
sure. Yeah,
you know, but what I do now in every aspect of my life, even if it's being an executive producer, you know, his spirit and his legend and what he taught me will always be part of, big part of that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And yeah, again, my, you know, I'm very sorry about that. When I think of you, I always think of Brutus, you know. Yeah. I mean, your career, you know, really, he was in so much of what you did. I know you were on like Oprah, you know, on Oprah with Brutus and, you know, having his dinner with him and what have you. And just, you know, that's, as you say, a big part of your life. So, but animals are animals. They always generally live less than us. And we, you know, that's the way it goes. You know, I've never spoken about this before, but growing up on the wildlife park, I had a couple of favorite animals. And people always, oh, what was it? The Bengal tigers? Was it the, you know, the puma? Was it this? And it was actually, one was a fallow deer called Tina. And the other one was a cow named Daisy, right? And the reason for that was both of them had incredible personalities. Personalities that shone through over, you know, we had everything from farm animals to exotic wildlife to, you know, mostly rescued or part of breeding programs. And these two animals for me were, I had a connection with. And Tina had two broken legs. They'd been pinned. She was in a car accident. And but she always recognized me from a distance, looked forward to me coming over to her, giving her a little, you know, tickle on the chin, and she would have a little cuddling, we'd nuzzle our heads together. And Daisy the cow was the same. It's a cow. She's a big brown cow. But she would love a big old scratch, and she would lick me and all this stuff. And you know, I was heartbroken when Daisy, she was 32 years old when she passed away. Wow. And I mean, she was an old cow, but she, you know, I was heartbroken because she was such a huge part of my life growing up and being around her. And the nice thing is that those relationships aren't replaceable. Like you said, you know, you've got other bears and you'll have other relationships with those bears, but they won't be Brutus. And, you know, I think what's wonderful is that you had, you know, there's so much you've documented with Brutus and he was so much a big part of your life. So again, love Brutus.
Yeah. You know, it was once he died, it's a lot of people reach out and someone said something, I cannot remember who it was specifically, but you know, they said Brutus made a million people smile.
Yeah.
And I just thought it's so powerful. You know, it's just, he represented a side of grizzly bears that, you know, you don't hear about. You know, you hear about grizzly bears when they're doing something wrong,
Sure.
usually.
Yeah.
And, you know, we know that the truth of a grizzly bear is somewhere between there, but he represented something wonderful and taught a lot of people things.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, I'm certain that he saved lives, both human and grizzly. He definitely changed the perspective of the grizzly bear to a lot of people. And so I think he left a massive footprint.
Yeah, yeah, which is so important, so very important. Well, I think it's wonderful what you're doing with the sanctuary and all of your other kind of endeavors other than the wildlife filmmaking side of things. It is amazing. And I don't know how you fit it all in, because I know how much, you know, those things time-wise take. But let's move forward to your programming. And you've done a ton of programming over the years. But I want to talk about this Puma's Legends of the Ice Mountain, because I know this is, you know, a big thing for you in terms of its pumas. It's kind of a dream come true for you to film this. First of all, so this takes place in Patagonia. You guys went down there to film. I think that they have the highest density of puma anywhere in the world in that area?
It sure seems like it.
Right. I think I've read that somewhere, but I know they're all over the place. So I've never been there, but certainly, you know, you and I know what it takes to track a mountain lion. They're not called yeah. ghost cats or the most elusive cat for no reason. They're hard to find. My wife and I would go out after putting collars on. We would have telemetry. We got up to 3 feet away from a cat one time when the collar was not working properly. We had to go and swap the collar out, and we're trying to find this cat. It was down curled up in a sagebrush, and you couldn't see it. You couldn't see it until it let us know it was there. And so they're elusive. So, you know, having that, the background that you have in Montana, being out tracking lions, finding them for people to film, just, you know, going out and tracking them for fun, and then going to Patagonia and seeing those lions just out with their kittens lying around, and you can get as close as you could to them with cameras. What was that like?
I mean, it was mind blowing. I mean, yeah, exactly what you said. I mean, I've had some success filming them in Montana, and that was mind blowing, right? If you see yep. one, get, you know, a few seconds a day of filming, you're just like, yes. Patagonia, the pumas down there, there's rumors flying around about them for a long time. And I had to go see it for myself. And had some friends down there that were telling me about it all the time. But at the same time, you know how it is. You hear these stories and you're like, maybe there's some embellishment here. I don't know. You know, this can't be.
It normally is.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
You got to go filter it out and see if it's true or not. And in fact, there's another, we were filming, I went down there and we were filming simultaneously when I went down there, and where I was kind of, it was an experiential thing. It actually ended up being a program on Smithsonian called Into the Puma Triangle.
Right. Yep.
And you know, while I'm down there, My mind's blown. You know, you expect, you know, we're talking about that anticipation of behavior. I mean, you get your eyes on a cat, as soon as you make eye contact with that animal, you know it's just going to go
gone.
Right?
Yep.
And if the other, you know, not there. You know, we have these cats approaching us. We have, you know, you're wow. seeing them everywhere. You know, walk by them and they don't even open their eyes because they're just sleeping. It was a wonderful thing. And what occurred to me right away was, this wasn't because they had been habituated to humans.
Right.
You know, it's not a lot of, it's just that they never learned that humans are bad.
Right. It's the opposite almost.
Yeah.
They just don't understand. Yeah.
And it's kind of awesome. You know, it's like kind of what you experience with bears and cat lion, for example. You know, it's just,
yeah.
You are there, but you are not on the radar. And you are seeing this like uninhibited behavior. You're just a fox, you know. You're just some animal walking by, and that's just peacefully getting along. And you know, with a big predator that is supposed to be invisible, and now they're visible everywhere. So you have all those questions, right? From running around Nevada and putting radio collars on, it's like, what's happening between each beep, right?
Yep.
And now you're there and you can see exactly with your own eyes what's happening between each blip on the GPS collar. You know what I mean? And
yeah, absolutely. Real time. Yep.
And that's, you know, for again, that curiosity, just that childlike curiosity that you have and wonderment. It's, yeah, like you said, a dream come true.
Yeah, I mean, it must, as you say, can be completely surreal just to have those lions look at you like that and not be scared. Because so many people, again, it's like you say about grizzly bears, it's same with sharks, same with lions. We hear about them when they're attacking someone, when they're doing something that we consider dangerous. And what people don't realize is, of course, it's one in a million. And there's normally, we actually got a call out by the sheriff's department when there was a lion that had killed someone's dog and it was being aggressive to people. And we thought, that's, you know, it's odd. That doesn't make any sense. You know, having tracked and been around many, many lions, that doesn't make any sense. But to most people, they think, well, that's a lion. Of course it is. And we're like, no, that's not a lion. That's just what you know, have been socially conditioned to think. And so we go out there, and it's like a 35-pound cub kitten, and it's been in a trap. It's got one paw half ripped off. It's managed to pull out the trap. The other paw, it's got the wrist all opened up, and you see all the bones. This thing's in so much trauma, pain, suffering. It can't move around properly. So sure enough, it did eat a small dog. It caught a dog because, hey, the dog was probably up in its face, and it's like, this is the only meal I'm going to get. So I went up and I tranquilized that thing from about 6 feet away, and it's giving me all of the upset. But you know, it had to be euthanized. It was in such a mess. But straight away, you know, our feeling was correct. There's something wrong. This is not normal mountain lion behavior. And sure enough, it's a trap, a hunter's trap that had, you know, or a trapper's trap that it had pulled out from. So, you know, we see those things, and it's just hard because we're constantly trying to explain to people, you know, in our roles as educators of these species that, you know, they are misunderstood, and we have to be very, very careful there. So going back to you being out there, you're out there, you're seeing these cats at this, you know, crazy close quarters. They're not worried by you being there, which is completely surreal. How do you then go about, I mean, I'll go straight to the meat of this, and that is that you in the program, you filmed a cat taking down a guanaco, or at least attempting to. I can't remember if it actually took it
Yeah,
down,
killed it,
but
yeah.
that's the kind of footage that here we dream of getting. You know, we've been looking at trying to film horse kills here because they're feeding on horses, and it's like, wow, if we could get that shot. But there, of course, you can just watch them and just wait for them to make a kill. So was that something you had been anticipating and waiting for, or was it something that you know, that just happened, you know, lucky enough to be on that cat at the time?
No, definitely anticipated that one. So this female specifically was a notorious killer. She was just good at it.
Right, yeah.
And she was a big character in our in the story that was kind of developing, so we were already following her. But we knew, you know, every evening she'd get up and it was going to be hunt time, and if you would stick with her, the odds were going to be really good. But
Right.
sticking with her was tough,
Yeah.
you know. In this case, what was amazing was that that was filmed on a RED camera with a, what is that, 70 to, what's that lens, like a 110 or something. It's just that little weird lens that's
Yeah,
going
yeah.
on.
Yep.
On there on a movie. So
Right.
literally walking with her hunting, which is amazing. And we
Wow,
did this
yeah.
several times. And then she started kind of going around this back area, and the guanaco are in front of us. And yeah, we knew it might go down, but now it's a movie. And so
With a
Ben,
short lens, a
yeah.
tiny lens, but
And if
yeah.
you watch that sequence, it's hilarious. It's because, you know, Ben's this kid that works for me that had the movie, and this all started going down, and it came right towards camera. And you're trying to pull, you know, you can't just, you know, you're not just moving the lens. You got to kind of do like the
Yeah,
rotate
you
it
go
toward, you
pretty,
know. And
yeah.
then she runs, and he tries to keep up, and then she goes out of frame and over this hill. So he just takes off running.
Excellent.
And comes running over the hill, and it's funny because while he's running, the camera tilts up, and as he comes over the hill, it just naturally pans down, and it's this beautiful, like you would never do, you could do it on purpose, but it just is
Yeah.
this beautiful mountain revealed to this cat
Yeah.
and guanaco
Just
smashing up and down on the ground. And
gosh.
yeah, and then just sit there solid and got the moment, you know, 50 meters in front of us. But yeah, no, I mean, it was the answer to your question is, you know, it was knowing and kind of pattering the animal and being at the right place at the right time. And then when it all goes down, just getting after it, yeah. You know, making it happen,
just making it
knowing
happen.
That it may not happen again, you know, and then at the, you know, that's one of those ones, man, we've all had that in the field. When you get done with that, it's just like you, on the way back to the truck to drive away, you tell the story 15 times, really excited. You high five 400 times, yeah. And you get back to camp and you drink a couple beers and you high five 500 more times and you watch the footage and you congratulate yourselves 1,000 times. And then you make sure you, when you offload the footage, that nothing happens to it.
Right, right, exactly.
Back it up 47 times.
I was going to say, yeah, not the normal three. It's going to be, no, we've got to have it somewhere else. Okay, let's send it on a plane now to another country. That's fantastic. That, I mean, you know, so I think many people would say those circumstances, there's luck, right? You were lucky. But sure. I mean, luck, I think, is a, you know, it's a loose term because, you know, Seneca, the philosopher, once coined luck as being preparedness meets opportunity. And I'm a big believer in that because you guys, you know, it's not luck. You were there.
Yeah.
You were after those shots. You were prepared and you were there ready for the opportunity. And those things met and you took it on head on and Ben ran across a mountain to film it. And that's the kind of camera guy you want to have with you when that stuff goes down, you know, which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, yeah, being there and sticking with something that long, there's a picture, it's been circulating, you know, forever, but certainly on social media now, it's like that whole thing of success, right? There's one guy digging away in a tunnel and there's the gold. And he goes, I'm done. This is ridiculous. It's never going to happen. He walks away, but there's like 1 inch of earth and there's this giant, you know, thing of gold. And wildlife filmmaking, I find, is very much like that. You know, we're just digging, we're digging. And after a while, it just feels like this is, it's never going to be broadcast. I'm never going to get the story, or I've got a budget, but I'm screwing this up so bad because I can't get what I need. And then it can just all happen, bang, you know. And a lot of the time, I mean, many of our productions that when we were working with Nat Geo Wild, you know, we would be filming for, say, there were short filming periods of 2 to 3 weeks, but everything would happen in that 11th hour. It'd be like you'd be really struggling, right, for 2.5 weeks, and then literally in 2 days you get the entire show, you know.
Yep.
You might use a few pieces from that 2.5 weeks, but everything's done in the 11th hour. And I think that sums up wildlife filmmaking. You know, it's perseverance. You got to stick with it. You got to be there. And then you get those shots. You get the lucky stuff. But you only get that because you've been there.
No, it's true. I mean, that's, you said everything perfectly. And it's amazing how that just holds true for everybody out there. You know, and you got to have that, knowing that there's that inch of dirt and the gold's on the other side. You got to have that hope all the time. And, you know, a lot of people... they want to be wildlife filmmakers, and that is the thing that breaks them. They cannot wait that long. You know, yeah. And I'll give you an example. This hasn't happened to me. I've been lucky. I have been lucky all my career. And I completely believe in the philosophy of Seneca. I mean, I'm with that completely, but I have been lucky in that formula. But just recently, I had this scenario that I thought was very predictable. With a mountain lion and go there. I mean, think anything is predictable. That's foolish to begin with.
Right. Right.
But I had some really interesting behavior going on, and I was, you know, getting it regularly. And I kind of put my reputation on the line saying, hey, I think I can get this, you know, and I put it through the filter. I really believed I would. And then, you know, I had some things with weather and it changed behavior. And you know, this production company put a lot of money down on my believing this was going to happen. And after a month of trying, I mean, and I literally didn't sleep, as longer it went, I just tried harder and harder. It didn't happen. We went home with nothing.
Yeah.
And spent a lot of time and a lot of money. And that does happen sometimes. Yeah. But when that happens, I think that's one of those things, like you have to take a deep breath. You got to reflect on why it didn't work out. And you got to grow and, you know, learn from that moment and how you're going to apply it to the next one, because it's not, you know, if you keep working hard, it's not always going to pay off, but most of the time it will.
Yeah. Well, and you know, failure is so much of the learning curve of success. You know, if you don't have those failures, then you probably won't get success, you know, in the long term anyway, because, you know, success all comes from trying and trying and trying, and there has to be many failures along the line, along the way. You know, we had a similar thing back around 2006. We were filming Wild Events, the series was, and it was all about the largest animal spectacles and migrations in the world, one of them being the caribou up in the Northwest Territories. And we spent 3 weeks up there and got nothing. And it was, we got nothing, not because of the wildlife, but because of the outfitters and being left without food and the plane not coming back and, you know, a disastrous tale. But that's, my production company is Nine Caribou Productions, and it's named that after that filming experience where we went to film a potential 1.5 million caribou crossing the tundra. And I saw nine caribou. We saw one in camp that came through, this lone caribou that just stood and kind of looked at us. And then flying out on the last day after filming nothing, I saw eight on the ground. So I named my production company Nine Caribou Productions.
I love that. It's a constant reminder, right?
It's a constant reminder.
Of the grind.
Well, and it of the grind, and the, you know, that series was still made. It was made into a 6-part instead of a 7-part series. Or was it 8 and 7? I can't remember now. But the point is that for me, the success that came out of that is my production company, right? Yeah. It is what it is. It was a learning curve, and it showed me fairly early on, midway through my career, that things can go horribly wrong. And someone has to pay for it. You know, there's always a tab somewhere that someone's losing money. But, you know, it was still a successful series, so that's okay. But those moments are, they're times when we could easily curl up into the fetal position, right? But pull the cover over our head and go, I'm done. I don't want to be seen on TV again. I don't want to have anything to do with it. You know, I'm done with this. I want a 9-to-5 job where this stuff doesn't happen. And of course, you know, you can shy away from it a bit, but then we're the kind of people that want this kind of lifestyle. We want the, you know, the uncertainty, like you were saying earlier. It's that, you know, when someone says it can't be done, you're like, well, I'm the man to do it, because that's what drives us, you know. And it's that's the pleasure in it, right? That's the pleasure. So awesome. So Casey, let's talk about advice to people getting into this industry. If you had to give just a single piece of advice for someone trying to break into this industry, whatever their goal is, and what, you know, in terms of title that they want to hold, a position they want to hold, these are people who are, you know, they've got a camera, they're out filming, but, you know, they don't see a path into the industry, because really there isn't a set path. Yeah, there's no blueprint that anyone has drawn up to say this is how you get into the wildlife filmmaking industry. What piece of advice would you get to people in that position?
Yeah, it's I think it's pretty obvious for me. I, you know, if you want to be in this industry, I say find the person that you'd love to be, I guess, at some level, or, you know, the track that you'd like to go down, and go up to them and say, hey, I'll do anything for nothing. For free.
Yep, yep.
I'll volunteer. I'll carry your bag. I will brush your teeth if you want me to.
Right.
But build that relationship and show them how hard of a worker you are. Yep. I think that's the thing with this. I've found that to be the main thing, is just building those relationships and getting through that door somehow, you know, and honestly, sometimes it is working for free, volunteering. I know for me, you know, a lot of those things I talked about in the beginning, I didn't do it for anything, you know, maybe gas money. Yeah. And for years.
Yeah.
But I got to show who I was and got an opportunity to grow from there. And I think that, you know, I always say too, there's another, you know, dust off the books and get your boots muddy. So I think there's, you know, leaning into some of those things too, is just like learn about the behavior, get out there and learn. And then, you know, that goes two ways. You can learn from a book, and you can learn by just being out there and getting your boots muddy. That's, you're going to have to get that experience too. So that's, I mean, my advice is, yeah, hunt these people down.
Yeah.
And
stalk them.
and tell them that you'll do it for free.
Casey told me to stalk this person. It was on a podcast.
Stalk them. Yeah, be a predator. You know, a lot of people, you know, I get this question a lot, you know, and there's things like, you know, the Jackson Wildlife Film Festival or going to Wild Scream in Bristol. This is where all those people that you want to meet are. And it could cost some money to get there. But I can honestly say that, you know, I've met a lot of young kids that are ambitious and got found their way there by volunteering at those festivals and hired them. Or in 10 years after I met them there, as they were, you know, volunteering and cleaning up after our parties, they're now commissioning shows.
Yeah, right.
You know, you just never know. And
that's right. And,
but they were, that's what they did. So, I mean, getting out there, going to some place like that, you know, you'd be, I think a lot of kids, young people would be amazed. I guess you don't have to be a young person, but budding filmmaker.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's all ages for sure.
Yeah, you'll be rubbing elbows and drinking beers with, you know, executive producers of Planet Earth. So I think that's what you got to go do.
That's fantastic. And, you know, I think no success, it doesn't matter what kind of industry you're in, but no success really comes without that risk. That the risk of, you know, one, putting yourself out there, two, the financial risk, you know, because the thing I hear about that all the time, because people don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear that you and I did tons of work for nothing and got in debt. And, you know, we didn't get into the place where we are in our careers from just getting a job and being paid. It doesn't work like that. You know, it can do in certain circumstances, but as you say, I mean, once you build those connections up, then really you're on the path, the track to choose what you want to do and see how that goes. But there's a certain amount of risk in it, you know, and you do have to put yourself out there and you do have to eat ramen noodles for a year or two, you know, three times a day, to follow your dreams. And I think that's the same as say for whatever industry. The nice thing about this is a very small industry, like you say, once you start to know people, put yourself out, go to those festivals, meet people. The connections happen very, very fast and people soon know if you're serious. I think there's a connection here between the wildlife sanctuary world and the wildlife filmmaking world. And that connection is, you know, when I ran the wildlife park in the UK, we had hundreds of people want to volunteer every year, right? Yeah. And you would take people on and you'd go, you know, it's okay. We only need like five volunteers. But what we'll do is we'll take 20 on at a time because only three or four of them will actually stay. And that's because once they understand what volunteering with wildlife is, they won't want to be there. Because a lot of people are like, oh, I want to come and look at the tigers. And, you know, I want to come and stroke the, you know, and just, you know, put my emotional energy into the place. What they don't want to do is shovel crap all day long. And get dirty and smelly. Get in the shower at the end of the day and wonder why you can't get that smell out of your skin, right? They don't want to do that. And it's the same in the wildlife filmmaking industry. You get people, as you say, they turn up, they go and see what it's like, and it's all just too daunting or complicated or hard, and you never see them again. Get that all the time. And,
that's been that passion, too. I think another thing is, as it continues on, I think when you're that, you realize that you have the passion and you want to be there and you don't mind smelling like crap all day long and you don't mind eating ramen noodles. It's got to live inside of your soul. I think it's got to be there. It's that perseverance you're talking about earlier that just will get you through those bad days. It'll get you through that wall of dirt to the gold. Yeah. You know, just the example, just recently I did a job for free because I was just so excited about it. You know, and everybody looks at me and it's like, you know, I have a business manager now. It's like, this is the fall of you, Casey, for sure. I'm like, no, it's not. It's not. It's actually why I am who I am now.
Yeah.
It's because I didn't care about money. I cared about this project and I wanted to do it. And I was going to take every bit of my time and my resources and do it. And I think that, you know, people like to work with people like that. People, that passion will shine through no matter what. And I think you gotta have, and you just, if you have that passion and you're someone budding in this industry, own it and stick with it. And it never goes away.
Well, yeah, don't forget why you're in it. As you say, I mean, if you have that passion up front, that's why you got into it. You love working with wildlife and a project comes along. I have a project. I'm coming up to Wyoming next week. We're filming a project pretty much for expenses only. And we're doing it again because they're people we know, we like what they're doing. And it's what I want to do. I want to film wildlife. And if I can do that, and hey, I get my expenses paid, and I like what I'm doing, that's what it's all about. That's what keeps me in this industry, like we've said over and over. So it's very, very important. Lastly, Casey, bucket list. You got what's on your bucket list in terms of maybe species and location?
Oh man, I've filled a lot of my buckets. So I was just weird having this conversation recently. Species and location. Well, yeah, one, I got a good spot. Yeah. Wolverines. Another one people said can't be done. There hasn't been a lot done about it. You know, a lot of captive wolverines have been used as wild wolverines, but I do know of a good spot, and I've been trying to get this project off the ground.
Can you give us the GPS location of that?
No, but it's amazing. You know, I saw like 6 wild wolverines in a day, it's an animal that's so elusive and so again the impossible. I've heard this in the industry so many times, so now it just makes me want to go do it so much. That's definitely high on the list. I'm trying to think of something else that's in that realm. You know, there's places that I'd love to go. I've never been, you know, parts of Russia. I'd love to go. I mean, Siberian tigers are always intriguing. They fall into that impossible thing.
Yeah.
I feel like I could track a cat in that world. Otherwise, man, anytime there's any weird stories out there, it's always looking, it's not always just the elusive, but there's those strange stories I think that need to be told, you know, that people, we just don't know. Another example is this, you know, what we've learned about mountain lions and how social they are just in the last 10 years. I think there's a lot to learn about a lot of animals that we don't know a lot about. And just got to get out there and endure those moments and spend a lot of time out there, and the stories will come alive. For sure.
What's
your bucket list?
Say again.
What's your, on your top of your bucket list?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, it's funny. I don't really have, I mean, you know, I fell in love with whale sharks. 26, 27 years ago, I had this epiphany with a whale shark on the Ningaloo Reef off of the west coast of Australia. And it really was something when I was struggling with, I was at the wildlife park, but I was, you know, early 20s at this point. I'd been there from, you know, I left school early. Been working at the wildlife park because it was a family wildlife park, and I kind of got to the point of like, is this what I want to do? I mean, I loved it, but it was like, I'm not sure that I can stay here and just do this. Is there more? And I traveled Australia for a year. I trained as a chef for two. I came back to the UK. Thought I want to be in Australia. I trained as a chef because there were the two. They had a list of careers that you could move into the country with, right? And it was like brain surgeon, chef were at the top of the list. And I'm like, oh, brain surgeon, chef. Oh, I'll try chefing. So I trained as a chef for 2 years, and I went back out to Australia, got a job in Highlight 33. It was a revolving restaurant in Perth. It's called something else now. And but before I did that, I wanted to go and fulfill this dream I had of snorkeling with the whale shark. So I went up and got in the water with this incredible whale shark, and with a couple of them actually. And I had a small CNC, like Instamatic underwater camera. That's what they were in those days. You know, they cost a fortune. They were just an Instamatic camera, right? Yeah, I took that down with me. Yeah. Bright orange, you know. I took it down. I'm taking pictures, and I can't see anything through the viewfinder. Nothing. It's all fogged up. And anyway, long story short, I suddenly feel this pressure in my kind of sternum. And I pull the camera away, and it's the corner of the mouth of the whale shark. While I'm messing around my camera, it's pushing me through the water with the corner of its mouth. And I'm just like, I let go of the camera, which floats to the top. And then it kind of pushes me off, and it goes by, and I just look into its eye, and my eyes filled with tears. I was just so overwhelmed with emotion. And it was that moment, there was a knowing inside of me. It sounds cliche, but it's absolutely how it happened. There was this knowing that, what the hell am I doing being a chef? I don't want to be a chef. Why am I doing this? Why am I here? I'm here to experience this. I got out of the water, I was in the water for the rest of the day, but that day, you know, at the end of the day, I got out and I booked my ticket back to the UK to go and run the wildlife park. And it was that moment that sealed for me that I needed to work with wildlife. And so I've had this connection with whale sharks ever since then. I've never done anything with them since. So I would love to go and film whale sharks again. I think, you know,
yeah, it's exactly.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's one of those things. I'd love to take my boys, you know, to go and snorkel with them as well, and just go back to that place. So that would be incredible. But what I was going to say, as well as that, is what I love about this is the way that you find stories and they unfold in front of you. Like, you know, you can be going and filming something else, and you see something, and you go, "Wow, that's a story that I had no idea." And it might be about a dung beetle. Or it might be about, you know, I don't know, a hawk, or it could be anything that suddenly just a little, you know, light bulb goes off and you go, well, there's a story there. And I love that about it. It's not so much, it's more about the bucket list I don't know exists yet, right?
Yeah,
I know they're there.
That's a great point. I mean, exactly. Every location you go to chase a story and you find two better ones. It seems like everywhere. Right.
And then you want to get on and film that. And you're like, well, I better finish this one first, you know, and then I'll come back. But
it's so cool. It just reminded me, and it's a story. This happened recently, but I just got to tell it because it's one of my favorite stories to tell. You know, people often ask, like, what's the coolest thing you've ever filmed?
Right.
And it often is one of those things that just jumps out of nowhere, right? You're focusing here and then something else happens. But during Legends of Ice Mountain, we were out with that female I was telling you about. She had two young kittens that we'd gotten to know her and those kittens pretty well. And we knew it was that evening time she was going to get up and hunt. So we knew where she was. We went, we were kind of waiting, and they were laying around being pumas, you know? So one of the kittens was really kind of a mama's boy. And the other one was a more independent. And so his mama starts getting up and she's going to these high spots and looking across the view shed and trying to find where she's going to go hunt next. The boy followed her and kind of sat next to her. And we're in the vehicle, and at the point I'm like operating a shot over that's mounted on the vehicle. So I'm sitting in the passenger seat, following her with the lens, but then I'm, you know, same time while I'm filming her looking around, I'm just looking back to see what the other kitten's doing. And the other kitten is sitting there and just staring up at the sky. And so, you know, naturally I'm kind of out the window, kind of looking, is it looking at a condor or some eagle or something? It's gotta be looking at something. Right?
Sure. Yeah.
And I look, I don't see anything. And, but this cat is just catatonic, like a statue, just staring up in the sky. Anyway, so then I'm back and I'm filming mom, and you know, she's looking like she's gonna go hunt and leave the kittens behind, and you know, I'm kind of distracted with that. But then I look back and this little kitten has not budged, just staring and like just this focused stare. And I had to know what was going on so much. So I opened the door of the vehicle to see, like, maybe I can't see with it. And I get out and I look, and sure enough, here's the full moon in the sky, right where this cat, and this cat is just staring at the full moon.
Mesmerized.
And it just hit me so hard, because it was just like, you know, just another child of the earth mesmerized by the beauty of a full moon.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, again, it changes how you perceive these animals immediately. And, you know, of all the cool things I've seen, the mountain lions killing the, you know, guanaco, whatever, right? I mean, so many.
Yeah.
That struck me so much more than all those things, you know?
Just, yeah.
And, yeah, this happened recently. This is awesome.
Those little moments, those little nuggets that you just don't, I mean, in my mind, you know, other people get that feeling from doing other things, whatever it might be. But for us, I think, certainly for me, obviously you as well, it's those moments of clarity when you realize there's so much more that we just have no understanding about. You know, there's more to the whole thing, right? When we see these animals reacting in ways we do not expect, like that, as you say, a kitten staring at the full moon. It's just, it's those moments. And it's that feeling you get that I can't imagine getting from any other 9-to-5 job. I really can't. you know, those moments of inspiration and insight and just filling your heart. That's the way I see it, because that's what it feels like. It feels like your heart's being filled in those moments, doesn't it?
For sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Casey, thanks so much for being on the podcast. It's been awesome chatting with you. Where can people find out about what you're doing, you know, videos, or, you know, just stay connected with you online?
If you go to caseyanderson.tv, that's my website, and then also visionhawkfilms.com. And then, of course, it's social media. I'm a grizzly guy. I don't even know what they are, but those are usually my handles. I keep that up to date pretty good with what's going on, especially my Facebook. Although Facebook's kind of getting, shows my age. All the kids doing that Instagram and TikTok thing. Yeah.
You know, on MySpace?
I just got off last week.
Right. Well, I'll look up all your handles, and I'll put links to your social media and your websites on the episode page on the podcast website. So again, thanks so much for being here. I really appreciate it. It's been fun to chat.
Oh, been awesome. Thanks, Jake.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, then please leave a rating and a comment. And remember to subscribe to keep up to date with the series' future episodes. You can find out more information about wildlife filming at jakewillers.com. And if you're interested in starting a career in the wildlife filmmaking industry or being mentored to further your career, then please visit jakewillers.com/mentorship. Thanks for listening.